Hi, Damien Carrick here. Welcome to The Law Report. Today, using offensive language. Should it be a crime? And no surprise, this program comes with a language warning. Last week, Sydney street identity Danny Lim had a $500 fine overturned by the New South Wales District Court.
When I came here, you know, at the end of 63, you know, and I learned so much, you know, about the freedom of association, the freedom of movement, and freedom of speech.
6 days of every week, the eccentric 75-year-old walks the streets of Sydney for between 6 and 8 hours each day. He chats with pedestrians and waves at passing cars, and he always wears a sandwich board emblazoned with a message.
Initially, it's a smile for peace, and peace be with you. And that's why I eventually have a lollipop sign too. One side is a smile, the other side is a sad face.
Ah, sad face one side, smiling face the other.
Yeah.
So you want to what? Make people happy? Is that what you're trying to do?
Yeah, because it, you know, make them to say, this is the one and only life, you know. Why you let the politicians scare the shit out of you, right? They are the one, you know, should make you happy.
The messages on the sandwich board regularly change, and they often reflect the political issues of the day. Brian Wrench, who works with Murphy's Lawyers, is Danny Lim's lawyer.
He's a peace-loving activist who really wants to get his message across.
And what is his message? I mean, he has many messages.
Look, a lot of them obviously are left-leaning. He always has views about immigration. He has views about politics. He has certain views about politicians and what they're doing. But his general message is, as his sign, peace, love and happiness.
And he basically wanders the streets of Sydney for anything up to 8 hours a day with sandwich boards displaying his posters and maybe placards as well.
Well,
right?
Look, I think he probably works longer hours than some people in office. You know, it's a full-time job for him. and he certainly doesn't get paid for it in a monetary sense, but he certainly, a lot of people do like him. A lot of people do love him.
And he's quite a well-known figure in central Sydney and inner Sydney, isn't he?
Oh, look, he's certainly an institution. I think actually he starred in a few music videos, in fact, so much so. He's certainly a character of Sydney.
Now, does he have any kind of criminal record?
None. None whatsoever.
So he was walking around the city with the sandwich boards August the 24th, 2015.
I think
it was in Edgecliff, maybe, in the eastern suburbs. What was on that particular sign?
Well, I should point out this. This was at a time when Tony Abbott had recently just said, look, good governance starts today, you know, basically saying that he was going to change things. And at that time, a lot of people were obviously sceptical about that, and Danny Lim decided to protest about that. So he wore a sign saying, peace, love, happiness. People can change. Tony, you can't, I suppose, with an upside down A instead of a U. It was a play on words, basically. It was a joke. It was completely jocular. I mean, play on words have been going on for years and years and years, and it was meant to highlight the message, what people felt about it, but also to say that Tony Abbott couldn't change.
I did it more as a pun. It's a play of word.
Were you trying to be funny or were you trying to be offensive? What were you trying to be?
Not trying to be offensive. I tried to make people think that the real word, you know, the C-U-N-T, is in Chaucer's Canterbury Tale, is in Shakespeare. Should be, you know, with the gender respect, gender equality, you know. It should be a beautiful word. It shouldn't be a dirty word.
Would you have used the same play on words if you were talking about a female politician?
I'll never do it because I'll never do it to a woman. To this, you know, the main thing is people can change. Tony, you can't understand. And the thing, you know, if you take the totality of the whole language, you know, it's a play word, it's a pun. It's about time we have a sense of humour. If you don't have a sense of humour, how could it be an Aussie? And at the end, whatever people want to read that way, nothing can do. Just the word buggery, you know. And I found out, gee, that's a terrible word. And then Bob Hawke, when Alan Bourne, you know, won the America Cup, you know, He said anyone that, you know, sack anyone or drop their name, what, you're a bugger off, right? He used the word bugger. And in Australia, another word, you know, the word bastard is a mate at a bastard club. If you call a pommy a bastard, they'll kill you. And then talking about the real word C-U-N-T, so many Irish people came to see me, women, they say, Danny, in Ireland, that's a very common word. We say it all the time. Even in Australia, it's how you mean, you know, and how he take it. But if you say to a friend, you know, which you know, they know, you know, it's a common word. A C-U-N-T means acquaintance. It's a good mate, something, you know, you admire. But anyway, you know, this is Australia, right? And in other countries, maybe they take it very hard, you know.
Brian Wrench, what exactly was Danny Lim charged with? What's the exact piece of legislation?
He was charged with acting in an offensive manner, which is slightly different to actually offensive language.
Initially, the magistrate at first instance said, yep, you're guilty, but you appealed this decision. What were your arguments and what did the judge in the district court, Judge Scotting, find last week?
Well, initially, the magistrate at the first instance basically found that the conduct was offensive and there was no reasonable excuse for this type of conduct. She gave him a monetary fine. For Danny, it wasn't about the money. It was about the principle in the matter. So I appeared at local court and we decided to take it on to the district court before His Honour Judge Scotting. It was a bit of a multi-pronged argument, and the first aspect was about whether or not the conduct was indeed offensive according to reasonable persons, because reasonable persons are meant to be sort of thick-skinned, and in the circumstance of this, where there was no intention to be directly offensive, and where in the circumstances we're in a sort of changing society at the moment, where people are less offended by certain things, His Honour said, look, it is not offensive whatsoever.
The judge spoke about the prevalence of the impugned word in the Australian language. What did he say?
Well, he actually analysed the history because it's been around since the 12th century and it's been published in many books as well and famous books. One of the most famous trials occurred in the 1960s and it was a book by the famous author D.H. Lawrence, Lady Shatley's Lover. They use that, the word, about 8 or 9 times in that context. Another famous book by Hugh Selby, Last Bridge to Brooklyn, also used that word. So it's not the first time this word has been used because it all depends on context. And it was almost a bit of a surreal moment because we were in court using the word. Obviously, it couldn't have been held to be offensive because we're talking about it in a courtroom. Mm. So it's all about context and the use of the word. And in these circumstances, where it's used for a purpose of highlighting a political message, it wasn't offensive.
The judge also said in his reasons, references to the impugned word are often included in print media, usually a reference to a direct quote with the U or the U and the N removed with, you know, sort of dot, dot. You see that in mainstream media all the time. And that's kind of what he was doing. And that's also another point that the judge made, didn't he?
Yeah, that's right.
And ultimately, the judge decided that, quote, I am not satisfied beyond reasonable doubt that a reasonable person, considering all the circumstances, would have had a significant emotional reaction such as anger, disgust, resentment or outrage to the appellant's conduct. While it's inappropriate and in poor taste, I'm not satisfied that it was offensive.
Yeah, I think most people who have spoken about it had the opposite effect. They actually laughed about the sign as opposed to arousing anger or disgust or resentment when seeing it.
I do wonder, though, if he'd used exactly the same placard, but his target had been Julia Gillard, Julie Bishop, Gladys Berejiklian. Playing with the C word and a woman, people might find that deeply offensive. And people might find the use of the C word to be misogynistic, generally speaking, as well.
It all depends on the context and delivery. If it was maybe used in a different context against those, it quite possibly could be. But in these circumstances, where Tony Abbott was at the time talking about change and things like that, and he himself had been using swearing, you know, in some of these things. I remember when there was one of the soldiers who died, Tony Abbott said, you know, shit happens. Depends on the person, depends on the context. Because It can actually even be used in a term of affection as opposed to some sort of derogatory comment. It all depends on context and the intention behind it.
But does it also depend on how it's heard? And I'm thinking that for many women, it's a deeply misogynistic term. For many people, it's a deeply misogynistic term.
It depends on the intention. We live in the 21st century, and there are certainly many things that could be offensive without using any swear words. And I think that's probably the point in this situation, is that just because he used the swear word doesn't necessarily make it offensive. Equally, there are people who can not use swear words, and that what they've said is deeply offensive. We don't have any formal rights in Australia, but one of the formal rights is an implied freedom of political communication. And that was one of the issues that was going to be raised in this context in terms of the statutory interpretation. You know, in the Constitution, we don't have many rights. We only have two rights. One is a right to a fair trial. The other is freedom from political communication. And that was one of our key aspects in sort of pushing this.
The judge in the district court said in terms of this implied right to political communication, look, if I am wrong and this language is offensive, nevertheless, Danny Lim still has a reasonable excuse for his action and then referred to this implied right of political communication. Is that a correct way of characterising what's
correct?
The different reasons?
That was, if I could say, a second pillar to it. Even if it was offensive, he has a reasonable excuse because of the interpretation, giving effect to our right to communicate our message in a free way.
Lawyer Brian Wrench. Last week, his client Danny Lim had a $500 fine for offensive behaviour quashed. A fixture on the streets of Sydney, 75-year-old Danny Lim recently starred in a video clip by hip-hop group Yeah Gee Boys. I'm Damien Carrick and you're listening to The Law Report, broadcast on ABC RN, ABC News Radio and Radio Australia. Of course, you might be podcasting the program, available from the ABC app. Today, a warning. We're talking offensive language, so please do expect some. On the other side of the Pacific, the law around these issues is much more black and white. Back in 1968, as a protest against Vietnam War conscription, Paul Cohen wore a jacket to a courthouse emblazoned with the words F... the draft. He was arrested and sentenced to 30 days imprisonment. The Supreme Court overturned his conviction partially on the basis of First Amendment freedom of speech arguments. More recently, in 1997, in Adelaide, 19-year-old Daniel Pfeiffer was fined for wearing a T-shirt, which was ironically a birthday gift from his mum. The T-shirt was emblazoned with the name of a song by punk band The Dead Kennedys. Mr. Pfeiffer argued that he wasn't trying to offend anyone, but the Supreme Court of South Australia ruled that in that state, intention is irrelevant to the offence. Strangely enough, once they won the court case, police didn't go back and actually fine Mr. Pfeiffer. But of course, most people who receive fines for offensive behaviour aren't political protesters or punk rock fans. Luke McNamara is a professor of law at UNSW.
The New South Wales Bureau of Crime Statistics and Research collects data every year on these and all crime matters. And the figures tell us that about 3,000 times a year, the police use Section 4A of the Summary Offences Act, that is the law that makes it an offence to use offensive language in a public place. And that law is used in a variety of ways. And the most common ways are that charges are brought against an individual and that matter is heard in court. But also police make heavy use of on-the-spot fines in this space.
What sorts of fines are we talking about?
The maximum fine under the legislation is $660. That's a maximum fine that the court can impose. But curiously, and I would say disturbingly, the police have the power to issue an on-the-spot fine, which typically an on-the-spot fine is a small fraction of the maximum fine. On this occasion, however, the on-the-spot fine is $500.
What do you think of these laws?
I'm concerned that we continue in the 21st century to contemplate, not just contemplate, but to actually affect the criminalisation of the use of particular words. I'm concerned for what that means about our commitment to free speech and political protest. And I'm particularly concerned about what it means for our continuing failure to confront the fact that these laws operate disproportionately and harshly, and there is such a long history of Indigenous Australians being on the receiving end of these laws that I think we really need to give them a second look.
Well, what do we know in terms of the figures about who finds themselves at the wrong end of the stick in terms of these sorts of charges, these sorts of fines?
In terms of the most recent data, of the 1,500 or so matters that were resolved in the New South Wales local court for offensive language in 2016, 35% of those involved an Indigenous defendant. I mean, the reality is that, and these things overlap, but people who spend more time in public places, because that's their world, they're much more vulnerable in this context. So there is a significant class dimension to this. I think young people, people from particular marginalised groups who spend more time in public, are more likely to be coming to the attention of the police and are more likely to be involved in the sorts of conversations and encounters which give rise to offensive language charges. Because one thing that's important to recognise here is that in the vast majority of cases, the swearing that occurs, and swearing is usually the basis for an offensive language charge, the swearing occurs in the context of a conversation, confrontation with police. That is, it only occurs, the behaviour, because of the nature of that interaction. It's not as if the swearing was happening in most cases beforehand and the police come along on the scene. So there's a really interesting dynamic here. So another aspect of what's going on here is that it's a reflection of broader tensions about how the police have relationships, good or bad, with particular sectors of the community.
Well, it also goes to the interaction with the police. I mean, maybe if you are shouting at somebody using expletives, that's also accompanied by, you know, anger, aggression, threats.
Yeah, absolutely. And perhaps if we put threats to one side, because that might take us into the space of where that behaviour might constitute a crime in and of itself. If we just recognise the fact that you're quite right, that often the words that are used that are assessed by the police as satisfying the definition of criminally offensive, they are often, yeah, in a heated environment. And often what's at stake here is not the mere fact of swearing, but swearing at a police officer. And I think we really need to interrogate whether that's what these laws were for. Ostensibly, they're not about swearing at police officers. They're about using offensive language in a public place, engaging in behaviour which the community regards as unacceptable because it impedes our free and our access to public space and the amenity of public space. I think there's quite a bit of a difference between what these laws are said to be about on their face and how they operate in practice.
Do we know anything about the words used in these offences? Do the stats break it down in that detail?
Yeah, they do. A vast majority of offensive language charges are instances in which one of two words is used either in isolation or in combination, and those two words are fuck and cunt. So most research which has been done on this has shown that upwards of 90% of offensive language cases are triggered by the use of one or both of those words.
The decision handed down last week involving Danny Lim, do you think that was the right outcome?
I do. I think it was the right outcome ultimately, because the court determined that the behaviour in which Mr. Lim had engaged did not breach the criminal standard of criminally offensive.
Last year there was a case involving New South Wales Upper House member Fred Nile. You know, he's a conservative Christian Democrat politician. Can you remind me what happened in that case?
Yeah, so there was a protest in Belmore Park. There was a rally that Fred Nile was involved in, which was expressing a particular view about the undesirability of same-sex marriage. And a number of individuals were involved in a counter-protest and were protesting against homophobia and were protesting against Fred Nile. And in that context, various statements were made by the counter-protesters.
They shouted F Fred Nile and F off through a loudspeaker at those who were holding the rally, right?
That's right, that's right. And the police charged them with using offensive language in a public place.
What happened?
Well, the magistrate found that the use of the word in those contexts was not offensive. And I think that was an entirely appropriate outcome for two reasons. My own view is that the use of a word which is in such wide circulation should never be the basis in and of itself for a criminal charge. And secondly, in this context, and this can be hard to hear if you're on the receiving end of this sort of language, but I think it's important. I think we should be especially keen to recognise that there is a latitude that should be granted to people in terms of how they express their political views. And so the mere fact that people might use colourful language or even a language which we would never use ourselves in different contexts to express a political view, I think the political context needs to be taken into account. It was relevant to that particular case and it was relevant to the Danny Lim case as well.
Coming back to Danny Lim, look, he's a great poster boy, a great symbol for highlighting issues around these laws. Very sweet, very polite, personally a very warm and charming man. I've heard that from a number of people. He appeals to people with left-wing politics. But should that same group perhaps be very careful about what they wish for? Because if somebody wants to use exactly the same word play on placards, but their agenda is, I don't know, against Muslim immigration, against terminations, against same-sex marriage, many people would find that offensive.
Sure, but I think there's an important distinction to make there. We need to drill down into what it is that we want to characterise as offensive and perhaps inappropriate. Is it the use of a particular word? And I would argue that it will rarely be the case that that's a justification for reaching that view that a community standard has been breached. Or is it the expression of a particular underlying value or sentiment that our society regards as objectionable? So I would say, again, that the content which we should be critically analysing in terms of assessing what the legal response should be is the message, is the values, not the particular words used. I think it's too crude an approach to focus in on the use of particular words. And so if people are conveying particular messages which are regarded as inconsistent with Australia's values or laws on anti-discrimination, for example, then arguably there we've got a live question as to whether or not the law should be invoked to regulate that behaviour. The mere fact they've chosen by virtue of their own vocabulary or their own lack of decorum, whatever you want to put it down to, if they've chosen particular words, I don't think that's the heart of the issue.
Are you saying there's a difference between an expletive and the use of, say, a term which is clearly a kind of a racial insult?
Absolutely. I think there's no question. Because expletives are used in all sorts of contexts, in some contexts without any intention of causing offence whatsoever. We all know people who use the word fuck as every second word. That's just in the nature of their vocabulary. They use it in quite diverse ways, quite effectively. So, you know, I think we're sophisticated enough in terms of our ability to analyse language and message that we can get beyond the surface of particular words, because the reality is that our attitude towards particular words changes. So in the 19th century, the most common words to give rise to offensive language charges were words like bloody. I mean, can you imagine today if there was any suggestion that a charge might be laid in these circumstances? So what we're seeing now is that magistrates are chipping away at the idea that a particular word like fuck can just be regarded as inherently criminal. Magistrates are holding, not all of them, but some of them are holding that that is no longer the case. District court judges are beginning to do the same thing. And I think we're getting to the point where we need to recognise that the mere fact of a certain word or words being used is not a legitimate enough basis to criminalise that person's behaviour.
Does it make a difference, though? I guess so far we've been talking about authority figures or powerful people. We've been talking about politicians. We've been talking about the police. I'm wondering, would it make a difference? Could I walk up and down my local shopping centre with a placard, the word can't with an upside down A, but the focus of my poster is a person who works in a local shop or a local school? It's one thing to carry that kind of material around at a politician or even a police figure, maybe, I don't know. What about a local, ordinary person?
I think that's a really great example. I think that my answer would take your question back to a point I made earlier, which is that what's objectionable to me about that behaviour is the underlying message or objective or motivation of the behaviour. It's not the word used, it's the fact that the person is using a particular set of practices, including a certain word, to intimidate and threaten and belittle and vilify an individual. To me, that's the objection. That's undesirable behaviour. That's not behaviour which we should tolerate. So the more we can drill down into what is the underlying behaviour which we want to condemn and undertake a fair assessment as to whether it's right to use the criminal law for that condemnation, the better off we'll be.
So you're saying that it is appropriate to use the existing laws in that kind of context?
I think potentially. I think with that example that you've given, that might be a situation in which that behaviour would be regarded as inconsistent with the community's expectations about appropriate behaviour in public. But another example that has come up in recent years has been a small number of instances where offensive language laws have been used to sanction the behaviour of individuals who engage in acts of public racism, particularly in public transport. And this, I think, was a really interesting development because in a context where some researchers, including myself, have argued that there really is a serious question as to whether we should even maintain offensive language laws, and I think there are strong arguments in favour of abolition, when these cases began to emerge of instances in which these were the laws we turned to when the community was saying, we think this is unacceptable, we want the police to do something. And when the police did act, they laid charges or they gave penalty notices of offensive language. And this was a really interesting turn in the history of offensive language laws because they've not got a long history of being used as mechanisms of anti-racism. And this, for me, was a moment in time where I thought, well, this is not straightforward, this is not simple. Abolition may be something which is deserving of consideration, but it is a complex question.
So the kind of examples you're talking about where somebody might not use a racially insulting term, but they might get in somebody's face in the confines of public transport and scream, you should effing well get back to your country or something along those lines, where clearly offensive language is being used with an underlying motivation of hatred towards that person because of what they look like.
Well, I put it a bit differently. It's the underlying motivation which is what is offensive about the conduct, right? So it's not necessarily the words used, it's what's going on in that scene. It's the racism, it's the belittling of an individual, it's the threatening of an individual. That is what warrants the characterisation of that behaviour as offensive, and it doesn't need to turn on whether or not the person used a particular racial epithet because it was the underlying message which was deserving of condemnation.
Luke McNamara, how do you see this conversation around offensive behaviour meshing in with a conversation around freedom of speech?
Now, I must admit I was struck over the last couple of years in 2014 that again in 2016 we had robust discussions in Australia about the desirability and legitimacy of a provision in the Racial Discrimination Act which makes it unlawful, not criminal mind you, simply unlawful to engage in behaviour which might offend, insult, humiliate or intimidate based on race. And there were so many strong voices of objection to the very idea that such a threshold was acceptable in a liberal democracy. And I remember at the time thinking, there's an enormous blind spot here. No one is talking about the fact that tens of thousands of times every year across the country, a person is being criminally penalised. That is not just invited to a conciliation hearing or required to go to a civil tribunal or court matter, but criminally penalised for using a swear word on the basis that swear word is offensive. So I think there's a tendency sometimes to not look to the wider landscape to become a bit issue specific, but I think we do need to look more closely at how particular words, how particular concepts like offensiveness are used across different legal contexts.
UNSW Law Professor Luke McNamara. Are you pleased or relieved by the ruling last week of Judge Andrew Scotting?
I was very pleased now. You know why I'm pleased? I did it for the people of Australia. It's freedom of speech. If you think that word is what it is, so is freedom of speech.
75-year-old Sydney resident Danny Lim, who last week had a $500 fine overturned by the New South Wales District Court. That's the program for this week. I'm Damien Carrick. Thanks to producer Anita Barrow and technical producer Oren Gerassi. Talk to you next week with more law.